was made. Good morning. Welcome to the House Education Finance Committee. We will call you to order. We have a quorum, and with that, our first order of business is to look at the minutes. Representative Purcell, I see you are preparing yourself to look at the minutes.
Madam, I move the minutes from our previous meeting.
Representative Purcell moves the minutes for March 9th. Are there any questions to the minutes for March 9th? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. The minutes for March 9th are adopted. Thank you. And Representative Clardy, I believe you have some guests today you'd like to recognize.
I do. There's a group of students from DeKalb. So I just wanted to say a shout out to them. I'm from Dakota County. They're from Dakota County. So welcome.
Thank you, Representative Clardy. With that, we are going to move on to our first bill. We have House File 995. Would Representative Berg like to come up? And Representative Pryor, would you like to move House File 995 before the committee with the intention of laying it over for the Education Finance Committee?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Berg, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you so much,
yes,
Madam
and
Chair.
Your bill is before us, so you can go ahead and proceed.
Great. For those of you in ed policy, this might be redundant, but this bill is really important to me. And it's a simple bill which just says that students get an extra year before they age out of public and charter schools. We know that lots of kiddos fell behind in the last couple of years, so this gives them just an extra year. Instead of aging out at 21, it will be at 22. And I am going to pass it over to either Tim or Solveig to talk a little bit about the fiscal note.
Ms. Beckel, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal. So this fiscal note on House File 995, the as introduced, comes in at a cost of $13.747 million in fiscal years 24 and 25, and $14.777 million in fiscal years 26 and 27. It also has a levy cost. If you look at page 3, it's sort of tucked away in the chart there, but you can see a line that says general education levy, and it has levy costs of roughly $3 million per biennium. But it is also worth noting that the costs identified in this bill overlap with costs identified in the governor's proposed budget. The governor has a proposal to extend the age for students to 22 for all special education students currently enrolled. So Representative Berg's bill is just slightly more expansive. In speaking with MDE, they explained that roughly 80% of the students who would be eligible for this are covered in the governor's bill. So Representative Berg's bill covers an additional 20%. So if you were to do the rough math here, Representative Berg's bill would cost an additional $3.4 million over what the governor is proposing, and that's including both the appropriation and the levy impact, and in fiscal years 24 and 25, and an additional $3.6 million in fiscal years 26 and 27, again, including both the appropriation and the levy impact. And if you'd like those numbers broken out further, I am happy to do that.
Thank you, Ms. Beckel. Maybe just briefly to remind folks why we talk about the levy impact and how we have a zero levy. Either you or Mr. Strong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, so it has been longstanding House precedent that the House Education Finance Committee has a zero levy target. That means that any proposals that are passed by this committee that have a property tax levy impact must be paid down, in effect, by the committee. So included in this committee's levy, or included in this committee's target, if there are levy impacts, the committee must pay for that so that property taxes are not impacted by the provisions that this committee includes. So in this proposal, property taxes would be increased, but because the committee would pay them down, they would not be increased.
Thank you, Ms. Beckel. With that, Representative Berg, I believe you might have a testifier, or would you, why don't you go to your opening first, or do you want to go to a testifier?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I do have a testifier that managed to make it on. They're teachers, so they're not usually available at this time. So as I mentioned, this bill is really important to me. Of course, my own kiddo had some struggles, and so allowing our kids that need it an extra year, I think, just makes sense. In ed policy and in this committee and the conversation around education in general, we talk about removing barriers. We talk about wanting every student to be successful, and that doesn't matter where they live. It doesn't matter if they're in special education or an alternative learning center. We are about breaking down barriers so that every student in Minnesota gets the chance to be successful. These are kiddos that want to be successful, but they're struggling. And so this is one way that we can help extend the opportunities for our kids to find that success. This was brought to me by a constituent who is also a teacher in the Alternative Learning Center district. Well, he was. Now he changed over to a different job, but he was very, very passionate about this at a time that I was very passionate about it with my own kid, and so we were kind of kindred spirits on this, and we worked on this because it was really important to more people than just the two of us crafting it in a coffee shop. So, Madam Chair, I would like my testifier to have a chance to speak.
Yes, I have Nate Christian on remote testimony. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Nate Christen. I'm an English teacher here at PYC Arts and Tech in North Minneapolis. I just wanted to share my support for the bill, and I brought some statistics to help demonstrate, I think, the scope of the problem. Here at PYC, in the 3.5 years leading up to the COVID pandemic, we averaged an attendance rate the mid to upper 60s, and we found that after the COVID pandemic started, for the four quarters in which we remained in distance learning, our attendance rate dropped from the mid to upper 60s all the way down to 23%. Students just struggled with accessing online learning. They, even once we were able to open our building again, they were very slow in coming back in. And frankly, we're only starting to build back up those attendance numbers, and it's a challenge. So that is one reason why I support this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you so much. With that, members, are there any questions or comments? Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Berg. Just two logistic questions. So is this, after listening to your last test firm, by the way, I don't really have a big problem with the bill. I'm just trying to understand some things. Is this a response to the lack of attendance and what happened through the COVID, or is this a long-term problem that we should be addressing?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Kreisha. Great question, and it has a little bit of a complex answer. Yes, we lost a lot of students through distance learning. We had a lot of students that didn't have access to good broadband to be able to consistently attend online learning. We also had students that were working jobs and taking care of younger siblings, and that's always been true. We do see that mostly, or a lot, in our alternative learning centers where kids are working because their income is part of their family's survival, or they're putting their education on hold. This happened a lot during distance learning, to help their younger siblings with distance learning because the parents were at work. So there are a variety of factors that have always been there, will likely continue to be there, but exacerbated by distance learning. And this is not a long-term solution. It's just for the next couple of years to let kids catch up.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, and thank you for that. That helped. And question for Mr. Strom, and just so I understand, how does this overlap with the GED program and more specifically funding? So if these students, if you're in school till 22, are they going to be on the per pupil aid? And it's not going to be a lot of money, but I'm just looking to see how that moves through.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia. Yes, with the increase in the aid, both in the governor's proposal and then again in House File 995, the students would not only be eligible for services, but be counted as pupil units. So there would be per pupil funding for those students. For those same students, then, that means that they would be getting an education through the school district. So programs like adult basic education, if the students would be turning to that instead, would probably see a reduction of some amount of the number of students they saw. But it's sort of a behavioral question, how many of those kids that feel comfortable in the ALC or other learning environment would also feel comfortable in an ABE style of program.
Thank you. No further questions.
Representative, any other questions, members? Representative Berg, final comments. And actually, I have a quick question. We've talked about this before, and I remember this from policy. But this is for students that are on track to graduate and close to it so they can get that extra time to get that diploma. Is that accurate, Representative Berg?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is accurate, although I think that one thing to consider is that all the kids, although they're on track to graduate, they're at different places in terms of graduating. My kiddo had 4 credits left, so this was something that was, frankly, it changed the course of his education. I'm just going to be honest about that, and he's given me permission to talk about it. Fortunately, he didn't need this to age out, but I didn't know that. We were able to make up a lot of ground. Simply because, to be honest, it got a little bit easier to sit down with him and help him over COVID. So for us, that made a difference, but I noticed a lot of his friends were further behind, and had he not been able to make up that ground, that was looming in front of us as a family.
Thank you, Representative Berg. With that, final quick comments?
And thank you, Madam Chair. Members, when I originally came up with this bill with my constituent, I didn't even think about the fiscal impact. It was just two of us sitting there caring about students. Sorry, I'll try not to cry. And thinking of what we could do to remove a barrier and give them the chance to really, really succeed and open up the world to them as a result. And so I was very pleased when Mr. Strom and I had some conversations, and I was really feeling hopeless that we could fund this until he and I talked a little bit more, and we were innovating and trying to think of different ways to make this happen, and then to understand that in the governor's bill there was dedicated money, and lots of our students will fall under that category as they have IEPs and different things that qualify. So again, I'm really hopeful that we can do this for our students in Minnesota, and I would love your support. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Berg. With that, we'll renew House File 995 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill. With that, next up, we have House File 2010, and Representative Hassan. We'll let you get settled. Welcome back to the Education Finance Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. I will move House File 2010 before the committee today for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill. Representative Hassan, proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 2010. Hopefully this is an easy bill that most people support. House Bill 2010 is a bill that authorizes a grant to Junior Achievement North. I was, doing some research on this group and checked out their website and the work that they do. One of their taglines that captured my my audience was, investing in tomorrow's leaders today. Junior Achievement North prepares young people with the skill set and mindset to build thriving communities. JA is part of a worldwide organization that was just nominated for their second Nobel Peace Prize. JA North supports students from kindergarten through 12th grade throughout the entire state. Their program is focused on building financial literacy and stability for young people, with emphasis on systemically excluded and rural communities. JA prepares programs help students cultivate entrepreneurship skills that can be applied throughout their lives. They partner up with business communities to connect the students' classroom learning to real-life careers and experiences. JA supports over 80,000 students across the state of Minnesota. They engage 5,000 corporate and community volunteers to bring their programming to life. Today, I have multiple testifiers. Two of the most significant ones are the two young ones sitting on the corners. One of them was recently elected a mayor, and the other one served as the executive CEO of Xcel Energy. How exciting. And they're only 11 years old. With that, Madam Chair, I'll yield my time to my testifiers, and we'll stand for questions.
Go ahead and proceed, and state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Jook. I'm the president and CEO of Junior Achievement North. I'll get us started today just sharing a little bit more about the organization, and thank you, Representative Hassan, for sharing your words and information with the group. And Junior Achievement North is really focused on preparing the next generation of our workforce, the next generation of leaders for our community. We are building financial stability for young people. We're cultivating young entrepreneurs and helping them gain those entrepreneurial skills. And we're exposing students to real life skills and careers. We're engaging 5,000 corporate and community volunteers and partners to deliver the curriculum in classrooms to those kindergarten through 12th grade students. We're focused on equitably serving students across our region. This year, more than half of the students that we impact will be from systemically excluded schools and communities. We have strong partnerships with school districts across the state. We have formal partnerships in place with both the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts. We're in partnership with many suburban schools, and we have a strong presence in many communities across the state, including St. Cloud, Mankato, New Ulm, Owatonna, and many others. Our organization has a $6 million annual operating budget. More than 95% of those funds come from private sources, primarily from our corporate partners that want to invest in financially literate, prepared leaders and workers for tomorrow. We impact 80,000 students in Minnesota across the state. We typically go into classrooms, the volunteers go into classrooms to deliver programming, but we do have a learning center on University Avenue in St. Paul. In that learning center, we have a business incubator space where young people can come in and have access to space and technology and mentors and resources to start their own businesses. And we also have two experiential learning labs. We have JA Finance Park, which is a program for middle and high school students focused on personal finance. So in the classroom, students will have several weeks of personal finance curriculum with their teacher, and then they'll come into our learning center and they'll put that into practice, everything that they've learned. They'll be given a life scenario. They'll find out how old they are, if they're married, if they have children, and what their job is, and what their annual salary is. And then they'll spend the day with us making decisions about how much money they can spend on housing, on transportation, on clothing, on cell phone plans, on food, on entertainment. And they'll have that learning experience to see what it's going to take as they're an adult and the spending decisions that they have to make. The other program that we have is JA BizTown. JA BizTown is for elementary age students. They have curriculum in the classroom before coming to us, so several weeks of curriculum to learn about what it means to be a worker in a business, what it means to be a citizen in our community. And then they'll come in and they'll run a city for a day. They have jobs, they vote, they give to philanthropy, they earn paychecks, they get to go on break, and their goal is to run successful businesses. And so the people that I have joining me today are a couple of those JA BizTown citizens, as well as one of my colleagues and an educator to share more about their experiences with the program.
Thank you. Next up, I have Dr. Karen Ruth Jarman. Go ahead, state your name for the record and proceed.
Karen Ruth Jarman. Thank you, Madam Chairman. This morning, I am here to talk to you about my personal experience as the daughter of two parents that were financially illiterate. I cannot emphasize enough the impact of that upon my family. It is so important that our children have the opportunity to understand what money is and how to use money properly. One of the things that I love about JA BizTown is that I see children joyfully learning about money and the proper way to use money. BizTown is a place of great excitement, and students, my students, have told me they will never forget that experience. Not only that, they don't forget what they've learned about money. So many, many years ago, I was a participant in Junior Achievement. I know, I don't look that old, but I am. And one of the things that I learned was how to write a check. And I still, to this day, write my checks the way I was taught to do so in Junior Achievement. That's the impact that it can have on children. One of my concerns is that I would like to see more students of color coming through that program, more Title I students. As we begin to build new buildings and new manufacturing processes in North Minneapolis, it's one thing to make the money, it's another thing to know how to properly spend the money. And so if we want to close the economic gap between white and non-white Minnesotans, one of the things that we have to do is to teach our children the proper way to use money. And making money can make more money if you know how to do that. So I'm here today to say to you that I believe you have the power to do something about that. And I am asking you with all my heart to please do something and help our children to have the opportunity to be not only academically sound, but also financially sound. Because at the end of the day, those two things go together. And so I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you so much. And then I think I'll let you guys swap seats here. And I have one testifier's name down, Addie. Why don't you go ahead and pronounce your name properly, because I know I didn't, and proceed.
It's Addie Joke.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Addie. I'm a fifth grader at Westview Elementary. Last week, I went to JA BizTown with my school. To prepare for JA BizTown, we learned about how to balance a checking account, how to use credit cards, and how to apply for jobs. And we had an election for mayor, and I was elected. JA BizTown taught me to be a great leader. While I was at JA BizTown, we got paid and got breaks. My favorite part was managing and being adult for the day. All of my friends had a great time and loved being at their businesses. We had two town meetings, and me as the mayor got to speak, and so did the CEOs. We had such a fun time. I hope other kids get the chance to go to JA BizTown. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And next up, I have Dylan Nguyen. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Dylan Nguyen, and I am 11 years old. I attend Westview Elementary School. My fifth grade class went on a field trip to BizTown 2 weeks ago. I got the role of CFO for Xcel Energy. During my field trip to BizTown, I had a lot of fun because we got to have real life experiences. I got to manage money, pay bills and loans, and buy stuff. I also got to pay my employees. We didn't have enough money to pay all our bills, so we had to sell products and energy. We did that by going door to door to other businesses. During break, the first thing we did was to confirm our paychecks and get debit cards. Then we ate lunch and voted. I really liked the experience I had at BizTown because we learned and had fun.
Thank you so much, both, for your testimony. With that, I'll go to member questions or comments. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say thank you to the testifiers. That was a great testimony, and I appreciate you speaking in public about that. My question is, when does this program happen? Is it, and maybe you answered and I missed it, but during the day, after school, weekends, when is that happening?
Either Representative Hassan or, oh, we'll go back to Ms. Duick. And I, Duick, thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, the programming happens during the school day, so the teachers often incorporate this within social studies time or English or math time during the school day leading up to their visit, and then the visit happens as a field trip would happen. They spend the day with us. They board the bus when they get to school in the morning. They spend the day with us, and then they head back to school at the end of the day.
Thank you.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you.
Representative Hardy.
Great program. Believe it or not, way back in the 70s, I think, maybe 60s, I did this in Lakeville. So we used to do the field trip downtown to Lakeville, I mean to St. Paul, where we had actually set up businesses. Now as a teacher, JA comes into our school for JA for the day. And also we have a group of students that does JA BizTown. And what's really important and impactful is the vocabulary is so age appropriate, because I wasn't sure how first graders or kindergartners were going to engage in it, but the curriculum spirals up and it's really amazing. So my question for you today is, how far up does it go? I know it starts with the littles, but how far up does it go?
Representative Sam, or? Mm-hmm. Can you go ahead and state your name for the record again, please?
Madam Chair, my name is Sarah Juck. Yes. Representative, our programming is kindergarten through 12th grade. So just as you mentioned, we build, right? Kindergartners are learning about saving money, and they're learning about quarters and nickels and dimes. Students continue to learn about their cities, their communities, our region, our nation. And then in middle and high school, we're incorporating, we have a semester-long personal finance course, we have these experiential programs in our learning labs, we have a company program where students identify a need in their community and they start a business, and they spend the better part of a year building a business. And so we go all the way through 12th grade with really robust programs and curriculum, all focused on financial literacy, entrepreneurship, and work readiness.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hassan, for this bill. I'm a big fan. I am always engaging young people in our community, and one of the things that I make them do, which is hilarious, is my husband's an MBA, and I make them go through a financial literacy class with him, because it is one of those things that we really need to make sure our young people know. And I actually just have a question for Dylan, the CEO, if he wouldn't mind joining us again.
Yeah.
Hi, Dylan. Madam Chair, Mr. Dylan, do you know how much you paid your employees when you were paying them?
Well,
go ahead.
Well, yeah. I think so.
What were those paychecks for?
The other employees got $783, I think. And the CEO got $883.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Dylan, I like that your CEO didn't make a lot more than its employees. That's very nice. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Fidella.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a couple of quick questions for, I can't remember the title, Executive Director or President, so forgive me for that. First one, has the organization filed its taxes for 2021 yet? I didn't see a 990 out on the IRS website.
Go ahead, Ms. Jook.
Perfect, Madam Chair. Representative, we have our 990. We have submitted it to our national and worldwide organization, and it should be available anytime. I think we submitted our final 990 just within the last month or two, so that should be available.
Representative Della.
Okay, look forward to the update there, and love everything with this program. We need more of this for our kids, 100%, so really applaud you for the mission and the work. I imagine, so the filing that was on there right now was for 2020, and that filing showed about $3 million in payroll and benefits to staff and about a $2 million loss for 2020. Like a lot of businesses, that was likely COVID, so just interested, would love to know, are we back now? Is funding okay? And just an assurance that we haven't continued on in 2021 and 2022 with a trend of significant losses for the organization.
Ms. Chip?
Madam Chair. Representative, thank you for the question. We have been, in COVID, we did take a financial hit to the organization, as many nonprofits did. We have rebounded, and we've run a financial surplus for the last couple of years. We also have between 6 and 8 months of operating expenses in the bank to protect the organization if things were to change financially in the future. We've also recently secured several large gifts, one being from McKinsey Scott, the philanthropist, which has given us just some additional cushion and support to be able to look at the growth of our programs and future support.
Representative Hadella?
Great news. Thanks.
Representative Pryor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick question. So as I read the bill, it's to expand programming right now. So we're in Minnesota schools right now, and this would support more schools being able to participate.
Ms. Chook.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. So our learning labs, our learning facility in St. Paul is currently at 50% occupancy. We have about 20,000 students that come through those doors every year for JA BizTown and JA Finance Park. This funding would allow us to impact up to 40,000 students and would allow us to expand. The programs that happen in our facility are the only two programs that are not free for schools. All of our K-12 programs are free, with the exception of these two, because of the cost that's involved with this field trip experience. So we've been asking schools to contribute $20 per student for the expense. The gift, or the grant from the state, the funding, would allow us to eliminate that expense for every one of up to 40,000 students to come to the program.
Thank you. Representative Pryor.
Thank you.
With that, seeing no other further member questions, Representative San, want to close us out?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for this great conversation. It's a great bill. Please, I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. With that, I will move House File, up to the top of my notes, 2010, over for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill. And members, thank you, everyone, for their testimony. Members, up next is House File 2056.
Look at my posse here.
Thank you. Representative Herr, welcome back to the committee. Representative Pryor, would you like to move House File 2056 before the committee with the intention of possibly including it in an education finance bill? Oh, Representative Pryor? you're studying it. So
yes, Madam Chair. So moved.
Thank you. Representative Pryor moves House File 2056 before the committee. With that, Representative Herr, go ahead and start your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Joachim, and committee members. By the way, I support that last bill, too. I have an MBA. Really important financial education. But thank you for hearing House File 2056. The bill before you is a request for increased funding to the Education Partnership Coalition, or EPCs. Just a quick overview of the bill is that Section 1 through 3 just cleans up language with EPC statute to better describe the types of grants. And then Section 4 is actually where the bulk of the information is, and it is to increase to the two partners. It provides an increase to the two partnerships that were put into education-based budget in 2015 and adds six regional programs into the base. So that just breaks down to $1 million each additional to Northside Achievement Zone and St. Paul Promise neighborhoods for each of the each year of the biennium, and then $220,000 a year to six of the regional programs, which includes Austin, Rochester, Red Wing, Northfield, and St. Cloud. And then it seeks new funding of $300,000 per year for the St. Louis Park Partnership Program. So EPC was codified in Minnesota statute in Section 124D.99 back in 2017, and EPCs engage more than 120,000 youth and families across Minnesota. Coalition members take a birth-to-career approach to eliminating Minnesota's worst-in-nation opportunity gaps, and all coalition members are locally controlled, data-driven, private-public partnerships. But truthfully, EPCs are special to me. I had the great fortune of being on the advisory committee for the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. It seemed like such a long time ago, but at that time, my girls were only in elementary school. They're 23 and 19 now, so this has been something we've been working and developing many years. And I gave up my career in the private sector so that I could be a stay-at-home mom. And what I saw every day in the schools really broke my heart, that in the same education, the outcomes were so different for the different children that were experiencing that education. And I wanted to understand more as to why that disparity persisted and what we could do differently about that. And at that time, I don't believe that I could have ever envisioned how well the Promise neighborhood would do or the reach that it would have across the street. But I did believe in dreaming something better for our children. And, you know, I didn't have the words, maybe educators did, but I didn't have the words back then to talk about a two-generational approach or supporting families from cradle to career. But I knew that we could build a system that would require, that would ensure a child's success was not determined by their zip code. I'm proud to report that SPNN serves over 800 children during the summer months to prevent summer slide. 100% of parents reported their children were more excited about school, which is amazing. And then 86% of students maintained improved literacy skills. I myself have had the opportunity to visit a number of schools in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood, and I especially like visiting when I get to be there on the days they have Harambe. I think that's every day, but it felt special to me being there that day. It's the way schools should always be, and if you haven't actually experienced Harambe, you should. You absolutely should go, because it shows us a new way of how to engage students and what school should feel like. So, Chair Joachim, I could go on and on about how wonderful EPCs are, but I do have testifiers here today who can tell you more about why we must continue to invest and answer any questions that you all might have. And so on the testifiers list, I think you have that list up there as well, but I do have Megan Jacket, who is a advocacy and a civic engagement program manager at St. Paul Promise Neighborhood, and I can turn it over to her for testimony.
Thank you so much. Megan Jacket, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Chair Joachim, Vice Chair Clardy, and members of the committee, my name is Megan Jacket, and I work at the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood. For over 10 years, SPPN has promoted racial and economic justice so every child in St. Paul can live a great life, pursue the career of their choice, and build wealth for their family. Today, I am testifying in support of House File 2056 to support funding for the Education Partnerships Coalition, of which we are a member alongside eight other cradle-to-career initiatives across the state. Education is a main driver of our work with families and scholars, as we have direct partnerships with three schools in the Promise neighborhood, forming a strong foundation for authentic community engagement and natural connections with our families. Through this engagement and connection, we take a proactive and preventative approach to help close Minnesota's education opportunity gap. At its core, our work focuses early on a child's life and considers the conditions of their whole family and whole community. From offering financial literacy courses and opportunities to build self-sufficiency through our People's Fellowship, to our family success coaches, working with caregivers to explain brain development, and promote reading in the home starting at birth. We know what is good for our families is good for our scholars, and in turn, good for our community. Such early and ongoing support, addressing economic and developmental factors, contributing to a child's academic success, helps minimize and even removes barriers to overall family success, thus allowing our scholars the opportunity to show up in school ready to learn and succeed. This is just a glimpse into our work at the St. Paul Promise neighborhood.
We thank you for your past investments that make all of this possible, and we ask for your continued support through House File 2056. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, next up we have Jeremiah Ellis. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Yurakim, Vice Chair Clarity, and members of the committee. Thank you for taking the time to hear from us today. I'm Jeremiah Ellis, Director of Partnerships at Generation Next, which is a regional partnership, a member of the Education Partnership Coalition. Generation Next exists to create solutions in education to the education challenges that cannot be solved in silos. For example, the silos of higher education cannot solely meet the post-secondary attainment goal without the partnership of K-12 and the workforce. At Generation Next, we bring together system leaders to target the pain points in the education pipeline, particularly in Minneapolis and St. Paul. You might liken us to an urban core division of the P20 Council, of which we are a member as well. Today, I'm excited to share with you briefly a few highlights of three areas in which we've harnessed data and collected action to improve education outcomes in early grade literacy, social emotional learning, and post-secondary pathways. In the early grade reading space, we brought together 12 literacy tutoring organizations, and Generation Next cultivated a space for them to share their promising practices and their program data. Now, this was a little bit risky for these organizations because sharing their proprietary information could put in jeopardy their funding, particularly when you're sharing that with their so-called competitors. But through a facilitated process and sessions, these programs participated in a way that supported their improved literacy for the students that they served, and particularly their literacy skill development. In the social-emotional learning space, we partnered with both local youth development experts as well as data experts to measure and determine how socially-emotionally equipped a young person is to learn. And through the analysis of the Minnesota Student Survey, it helped us to understand the social-emotional learning well-being measures. And our EPC partners are interested in further engagement with the Minnesota Student Survey to better address the needs of the students in their own communities. And finally, in the post-secondary pathway space, through a multi-year agreement with the Minnesota Statewide Longitudinal Educational Data System, also known as SLEDS, we've been able to visualize the various pathways to and through post-secondary, including the demographics of enrollment, completion, dual credit, developmental education, and employment. This pathway data has guided us to the pain points of that first year transition into post-secondary, and SLEDS has guided us to the two-year public institutions where our students are most likely to attend. And then from there, we've been able to direct resources and expertise to further enhance the innovation in those institutions. And so Generation Next, in conjunction with the Education Partnership Coalition, jointly address the education challenges across our beloved state. And we thank you for your time and ask for your continued support.
Thank you so much. And next up, we have Sandy Maleka from Northfield. Go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you. Chair Yuakim, Vice Chair Clardy, and members of the committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Sandy Maleka, and I am the director of the Northfield Healthy Community Initiative in Northfield, Minnesota. The Healthy Community Initiative serves as the backbone and convener for Northfield Promise, our decade-old cradle-to-career initiative whose flagship programs include our full-service community schools. Along with our Education Partnerships Coalition members across Minnesota, we believe that every child and young adult can succeed cradle-to-career if a community's systems are aligned and working collectively toward that goal. Our coalition uses a framework of shared community vision, data-based decision-making, and collective action and accountability to improve outcomes for children and youth. I was born and raised in Northfield, graduated from Northfield High School, and I now live in Rice County with my husband and three kids, where we operate a small cash crop farm. As a proud townie, I have witnessed the incredible way that Northfield Promise has changed the culture of our community, engaging leaders from across sectors and community members with diverse racial and socioeconomic backgrounds to work toward the common goal of making sure ours is a community where young people can grow up, live, work, and give back. Northfield Promise leads this work in three ways. First, we provide robust data tracking and visualization support to the community schools and other programs in Rice County. Our team supports more than 30 children and youth-serving initiatives to track and share data that allows programs to allocate resources to where they're most needed. Second, we convene community members and leaders, giving youth and families a voice at the decision-making tables. We hold decision makers accountable to improving outcomes for children and youth by sharing data regularly so all can see if what we're doing is working or if we need to change course. Third, we seek and secure financial resources, share evidence-based practices, and provide training and measurement tools that allow programs to actively self-assess and continually improve so they work better for kids. We are good at identifying and scaling what works. Northfield Promise and the Education Partnerships Coalition build our community's capacity to work collectively. No organization can do this alone. An ongoing investment in the Education Partnerships Coalition is essential to Minnesota's future so that we can sustain work underway and scale to reach more Minnesota communities. The Education Partnerships Coalition has a proven track record of leveraging public investments to bring millions of foundation and private dollars into Minnesota communities. As a coalition, we are building civic infrastructure to reduce disparities, leverage assets, and improve outcomes for Minnesota's children and youth. Your support of House File 2056, which provides consistent funding for the Education Partnerships Coalition, will strengthen our current support of full-service community schools and other programs while allowing us to scale what works to more Minnesota communities. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much. With that, members, that's the testifiers. I'll go to the table for comments or questions. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank all of our testifiers, especially those of you with Northfield connections. There's a couple of you up there. I moved to Northfield for the third time 8 years ago, and was absolutely dumbstruck by the numbers that have come out of our Promise community and all the great work that Healthy Community Initiative does. I lived at some point on the west side of town and thought that maybe my children would get to go to the full service community school, Greenvale Park. And when we moved to the other side of town, I was sadly disappointed until this year, where my children's elementary school also became a community school. And it's truly remarkable. And thank you for all of your data-based work, as well as just all the love. And if my community is any indicator for all these other communities that are happening across the state, I'm very proud to be a co-sponsor of this. Thank you, Representative Herr, for championing this. And thanks to the testifiers and all the work that you're doing across the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hadala.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good programs in a lot of communities. Just one concern for me, I'm kind of the attention to tax filings person here. So I looked at just Northside Achievement Zone in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. Northside Achievement Zone, according to the 2021 tax filings, carried over $9 million. So to me, that just tells me there was a surplus of revenue on hand compared to potential need if we're carrying over that much money. And then looking at the St. Paul Promise neighborhood, it's actually a program arm of the Wilder Foundation, which currently has $148 million in assets. So just concerning to me that we're going to add a couple million dollars more to the Wilder Foundation, despite if they're doing great work. I just wanted to make that comment as far as fiscal responsibility for our taxpayer dollars. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Padilla. Representative Herr?
Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Hodella, thank you for that question. I actually like to look at 990s as well. I did not look at the 990s for today, but we do, our testifier did have a comment that he could make to address that point.
Go ahead. Ms. Chalice.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for your question. And that's something that we could follow up with, give you some further information if you'd like that.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative Hodella.
I'm good.
Okay, thank you. I've got Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Herr. I remember in 2017 when this was first brought forward and how exciting it was We actually had some toddlers who were in the room, too. I kind of missed that. That would have been good to see them again. But one thing I that's so impressive about this, of course, we're talking about a partnership. I mean, it's not just the state, but obviously we're in partnership with some of the most viable, and the reputation of a group like the Wilder is just incredible. So I understand that partnership part of it is that we're not having the state fund everything, but it's having the resources and the leverage and the stability to say this is an important program. And that then you have businesses and nonprofits that are willing to partner with us to roll this out, but that it is key to have the resources of the state as in part of it. And I would love more discussion of the sleds, of the data element of this, and how we're building on the availability of being able to understand how we're able to collect data as we partner with other groups. And then, and how we create evidence-based programs, and then use that to promote best practices and to know where we're really making a difference in our community. And because I know that we had a great discussion in my office about that, and I think that would be something that just we want to highlight again in the committee is how data-driven this is and how important that is to the work that you're doing.
Thank you. Who would like to just make comments? Oh, Mr. Ellis.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for your question. I would love to talk more about SLEDS, and we'll just say a little bit about how we're utilizing that sort of information. I'd say 10 years ago, we were looking at way we were measuring post-secondary success was by the number of post-secondary degrees that we had in our communities. So what percentage of adults had post-secondary degrees? The way we've kind of shifted over the last couple of years is to look at our system. How many post-secondary degrees is our systems producing? And so we've been able to take that data from to having a better idea of the students who come out of our systems and know that 4 years down the line, how many of them have post-secondary certifications or degrees. What this latest kind of connection that we have with SLEDS has allowed us to do is to look at those spots in between, not just the outcome data of post-secondary, but the years in between. So we look at when a young person graduates from high school, their degree which they'll go into post-secondary or not, and they're continuing in that post-secondary success pathways or not, and kind of understanding the degree at which we are losing talent. And so that has allowed us to be able to dive in and understand a little bit more the nuance that is possible in that space, so that we can work with our partners, as you talk about partners, in higher education and in the corporate space as well, to look at the issues that these young people are having and want work in such a way that addresses the missing needs to fill those gaps.
Thank you. Members, any other further questions or comments? Representative Perestaika.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Herr. I'm glad to be a part of this work with you. Wilder Foundation is a housing. It's like a platform of a stage for this program that's so influential to our kids. The little smiles on the faces, I've got to experience just volunteering and walking into the Wilder Foundation and community. When those kids get their backpacks, when those kids have all types of great school supplies filled in and snacks that they're not privileged enough to have, and this is what our state's about. It's about putting those smiles on those kids and ensuring that their education, upbringing is positive, and it starts at an early age. And so thank you for presenting this, and thank you to all of the testifiers seated today. Gracias.
Thank you. And I'll have to say, too, is what I like about all your different programming is how much you partner not only with the community and the children, but the parents. And I think maybe Northside Achievement Zone, if you could come up for just a brief second and talk about the parenting aspect of this and how you pull folks in. I think it's an important piece that we talk that your programming does.
Yeah, I can talk for St. Paul Promise Neighborhood.
Sorry, St. Paul Promise Neighborhood.
Okay. So I can do a overview from my position doing advocacy and civic engagement. I'll speak to first, like, our people's fellowship, which I mentioned. It's the bread and butter of the work we do at the Promised Neighborhood. It's a five-month fellowship for African-American families who have a child either in the Promised Neighborhood or attending one of our partner schools. And essentially, it's a two-generation approach, as we've spoken to, where the kiddo and the scholars are attending SANCOFA, which is Afrocentric Literacy Curriculum, because, again, we got to get these reading scores up if we're going to prepare for our workforce of tomorrow and get our families on a pathway to college and career success. And then while our scholars are in the literacy curriculum, parents go through a curriculum called Parent Power, how to be more active and take up a larger role in their child's life, whether that's in the school setting, community setting, just to really focus on that family well-being so that the work that we're doing in our schools isn't just falling off the cliff when it gets home, or especially in our work with Summerside, we wrap our families tightly and support them year-round. In addition to that Parent Power work, they're also going through financial literacy and wealth building, and as we just heard from the good folks at Junior Achievement, how important that is, that if we want our investments that we're making on a state level to go that much further, we have to start with the family, the whole family at home, and their kiddos. One story I can speak to from a family member I just talked to, she's doing financial literacy at Model Cities, and her six-year-old right now is losing his baby teeth, and he has woken up to find what the tooth fairy has left. She's using her lessons from Model Cities to talk about the importance of saving, and he just now is realizing how much more you can do with $5 if you save up those five teeth earnings versus $1, and he goes with his baby brother to Toddler Tuesdays out at Mall of America, and he respectfully asked his mom if he could see her wallet, and he then took on an active decision-making role at their day at Mall of America saying, okay, we've got $20. What can I do with $20? What can we as a family do with $20? So it's work like that where we're serving the whole family, and then we bring that into advocacy opportunities such as these where we're taking the experiences of our families and scholars and advocating for changes to our systems that will change the odds for a generation of our families and scholars in St. Paul, really focus on that whole family city focus. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. I just wanted to have that briefly touched on because I know your programs all do such an incredible job of making sure, like you said, that it's just not staying with the child, but it's affecting the entire family and helping lift them all up. And Representative Herr, you had a final comments?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to address Representative Hadella's question about the 990, and maybe he and I can talk offline because usually the 990 looks at assets and liability, not as much as it's not like an income statement where it's looking at revenues and what you're making. So I'd love to maybe just dig in a little bit to understand if the numbers that you're looking at, because assets and liability just tell us what we owe and what we own in assets. And so, and because these are complete programs that have wraparound services, that there are facilities, they do own assets there. And so I just want to make sure that maybe we can talk offline and take a look at that specifically. But I do just want to say that this work is greatly important to me because of what I saw in the disparities. And as I started to do education work, people would come to me and say, you know, if I could help them work on the disparities that they were seeing. And I always told people, you're asking me 200 years too late, right? Like, if you're asking me to help you now fix this problem, we're too late. And if you're asking me to help you look at elementary school and high school, it's too late. Like, this work starts at birth. And the fact that this work and what we're doing and how we're caring for families and children starts at birth. And that early childhood brain development is so critical. And having been an early childhood brain development fellow and understanding the impact of that, like, we can't start when we're doing now. We have to provide this services and the support from when a mother becomes pregnant with a child, and then how do we support that entire family. And so this work is incredibly critical for me and helping to understand that my children might be grown out of the system, but there are many more kiddos coming in who need all of the supports that these coalition build and create for families. And so I ask all of you to support and continue to support this, because this is really something that we do standard across our state, not just specific programs in specific neighborhoods, because this is that important. So I ask the committee to support this, and I look forward to working with anyone who has any questions about the program.
Thank you, Representative Herr. With that, House File 2056 is laid over for possible inclusion in an education finance bill. Next up, we have Representative Edelton, House File 562. Representative Edelton, welcome to your committee. I'll let you get settled and go ahead and move House File 562 before the committee for possible inclusion in an education finance bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to move. That's my motion.
Okay. Good. With that, we are, have House File 2056 before us. Or, sorry, 562 before us.
Is it here? Maybe the other, whichever one.
And go ahead and start your testimony, start your bill.
Thank you. These are, these make you feel short, don't they? You're like, he's like down. All right, House File 562. What it does is it directly tries to deal with what's happening across the state with due process paperwork. And we have some of our special education teachers, again, this is across the board, are spending their nights and weekends doing paperwork that is mandated and required mostly federally, but we have some requirements for the state. And so we can't change federal law. So what we're trying to do is come up with solutions. And this bill has come to the legislature. I think this is the second year that we've had it. But nationally, we know that we have a lot fewer teachers than we did just a few years ago. I think it's 600,000 was the last time I checked. The highest teacher shortage, though, is in special education. With increased caseloads, paper requirements, teachers are really getting burnt out with having to work and use their family time on the weekends and nights. What this bill before you does, the fiscal note appropriates for 2024 and 2025, $200 million as well for 2026 and 2027, $141 million. It gives educators one additional hour of prep time, and it gives some creative ideas on how that prep time might be a district could barter and try to figure out how they intentionally want to do it. There has been some things across the state where you have groups that work together. You could also have a substitute teacher for some of those days and have once a month they, or once, or excuse me, once a week or once every other week they do some of this preparation work together. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll move to my testifiers so we can discuss the bill.
Thank you. First, I think we'll have Ms. Beckel go over the fiscal note briefly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Representative Edelson went over it pretty well. It's not too complicated of a fiscal note. I would just note that the first year does have higher numbers, and that's why you see in fiscal year 24, the numbers are significantly higher. That's built into the formulas in the bill. But yes, Representative Adelson got the numbers correct.
Thank you. With that, we'll go to your testifiers then. And first up, we have Laura Pringy. Oh, no, that's remote. We have Jasmine Myers. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
I believe it's still the morning. My name is Jasmine Myers. I am a special education resource teacher. I've been teaching for 9+ years. It's about to be a full decade for me. I'm licensed in K-12. I specialize in emotional behavior disorders. I was a former applied behavioral analysis before teaching. I have my master's degree from Walden University in working with students with emotional behavior disorders. Today I'm here to testify in support of House File 562 and to provide some information about the challenges facing our students and educators in special education programs and how your committee can address these challenges. As a special education teacher, I'm committed to preparing every student with or without a disability the opportunity to succeed. I devote 5 out of 6 hours of the school day to provide what is considered direct services to students with federal setting 1, 2, and 3 needs according to their IEP. That means they spend some or most of their time in the general education classroom. As the case manager of 18 students, I plan, I execute individualized education programs. Those are IEP plans in the form of small groups, and sometimes even with co-teaching, that's push-in services based on the student's IEP service. This complex process of individualizing education is a very fluid process, but it can clot like the arteries of a heart. Due to things like initial evaluations, reevaluations, IEP meetings, IEP draftings, manifestation determination meetings, and progress reporting. My district allows teachers 50 minutes a day to prepare for the school day and an additional 18 hours a year for due process time. That preparation time is the same for general education teachers and special education teachers, but that additional 18 hours, that is specific for my district. Not all districts are the same. They separate the way they provide that due process time in each district. I did a little research this morning because I have an evaluation to read for a new student. An evaluation is about a 24-page document with over 18,000 or 17,000 words within those documents, which means it takes me about an hour, the average adult about an hour, to read that document and then regurgitate it and communicate the expectations of that document with parents. I don't even have an hour in my day to read that information, which means it goes into my personal time. The expectations of the Individuals with Disabilities Act is clear, and its obligation to ensure that students with disability are provided with free and appropriate public education that is tailored to their individual needs. This legislation promotes appropriate education, which takes time. Time to prep, time to meet with parents, time to do observations, time to consult, time to draft and finalize those individualized plans. Special educators provide both those direct and indirect services within the school day, before school, after school, on the weekends, on holiday. Right now, it's spring break for me. I'm still going to be doing due process paperwork during that time because there is no time frame from when the federal government expects those documents to be done. I mean, there is a time frame. It has to be done in like 14 days. So that is the priority for me. Due process, or it's also considered indirect service time, is documented in a student's IEP, but there's no accountability. And my colleagues are left feeling overwhelmed with both the services and the expectation of the indirect service, and of course, the teacher shortage. As you start to craft a budget, I urge you to consider the needs of students and special educators. Our students deserve to have their needs met in the least restrictive environment. And our special education teachers deserve time in their regular workday to meet those needs. Teachers should not have to choose between their students and their families. We can all do better. And I urge you to fully fund the due process requirements. Please support House File 562 because every student deserves fully funded service providers who actually have the individual time each day to provide direct and indirect service time for due process paperwork. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the work that you do. Next up, we have remote Laura Pingree-Kyle.
You got it. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Laura Pingree-Kyle. Thank you to Representative Edelson for authoring this bill and her help on multiple issues related to special education. I have spent three decades in special education. In the past 15 years as the Director of Specialized Education Services in Eastern Carver County School District, and I actually live in Representative Edelson's district of Edina. Today, I am representing Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, MASE, Minnesota Association of School Administrators, MASA, Minnesota School Board Association, MSBA, Association of Metropolitan School District, AMSD, and the Minnesota Rural Education Association, MREA. We do not oppose House File 562, but we do have concerns. While we are grateful for supports directed to our special education staff and allocated funding, the realities of finding qualified staff, substitutes, and or available time in a teacher's day for additional prep is and will continue to be challenging until we improve the pipeline to our profession and reduce paperwork requirements. The intent behind this bill is appreciated and so important for the retention and wellness of our staff. Students gain the most benefit when they have qualified teachers in front of them. Adding additional time for paperwork during the student day removes teachers from the classroom.
Certified staff will have less time to implement IEP services within their schedule, and students will have less time to access specialized instruction. We are worried about the unintended consequences of districts needing to create and fill additional positions in a time where the candidate pool is very shallow and in some places non-existent. We suggest an alternative solution of paperwork reduction. This has been met with some resistance in the past, yet could have the most significant impact, as it would allow teachers more time to do what they want to do, which is teach, and it keeps our trained teachers in front of our students. We sincerely appreciate the intent of this bill. It is to help special education teachers by allowing more time. But thank you, Representative Edelson. Our concern with House File 562 is the qualified workforce to make it happen and a reality. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Pingree-Kyle. With that, members, we'll go to the table for questions and comments. Just a note for the agenda and time, we're going to be brief on this and then be able to move over to Representative Kreisch's bill and then hopefully get to a timely ending at about 12:05. I forgot that Mr. Hallard requested briefly past deadline, but that's okay to come up and testify. You've got 2 minutes because we want to keep on track here. And Mr. Heller, please testify to the bill that we have in front of us, which is House File 562. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Joachim, people on the Education Finance Committee, to come to testify today regarding House File 562. I'm a white male with a camouflage hat. The gray beard. Specifically, in 2015, the Minnesota Legislature asked the State Department of Education to set the text complexity of the special education forms. They decided to use an eighth grade Bexell reading level. They had a partnership with the University of Minnesota that came up with that. If you think about due process forms and the complexity of them, they also have total special education system, which ties all the lot of requirements and services that dance around special ed. It's very important that teachers understand that. They said the teachers, they said it was people with reading disabilities when they set this special education forms. However, it was four full-time lobbyist teachers that were asking for it. Adush Uni is here. He certainly can testify to that. I asked him to correct the web page on due process forms. I do support the bill, but for understanding purposes, it's one time to give time to get these forms, which is great, but to understand how you plug them in. I'm certainly open for feedback from anybody. If you go to 2694 bill, it's trying to define twice exceptional, currently a lingual word in the statute. Currently void in the total specification manuals for the Minnesota Department of Education, their own guide. Anyways, decision tree flow charts would be very helpful for teachers to be able to make decisions based on services for individual students, including the print disabled, which is currently being put in the Governor's Bill 13. 11 on page 34. I unofficially represent the twice exceptional print disabled, also known as the eligible persons or people first. Thank you for this opportunity to speak, and hopefully through the chair, Dush Oni could explain that to the chair if he wishes to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Heller, for your insight. With that, Representative Sensor Murrah.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Edelson, for bringing this really important bill. I definitely agree on the need for more time. You know, one thing that I think is really important to emphasize is that what teachers are working on are legal documents. And I think when we think about how much time is put into other legal documents, including some of the bills that we write here, like, it makes a lot of sense that the teachers don't have enough time in the day to do so. I also really appreciated the testimony around, you know, ensuring that there's more time to communicate that important info with the relevant stakeholders, whether those are paraprofessionals. We heard about, you know, the time for paraprofessionals the other week, the time that they don't have to really access and understand IEPs, the time to communicate that with parents. I think it's incredibly important. We did hear about kind of the paperwork reduction alternative, and can you talk a little bit about, did that come up in the research for this bill? Kind of where is that simultaneous work happening?
Thank Representative you. Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, yes, that is something that we have had a bill, a task force. So the complexity of this, as like a mom, as I have two children that have IEPs. They've had them since they were babies. There is an amount of this that is predominantly federal. And so streamlining that paperwork is something that we've talked about for years since I've been here at the legislature. And Representative Krisha, I think I even had a bill, and you and I had talked about it years ago. There was a task force that we kind of had moving around that's been since dropped, but I think we'll rejacket that to try to, I don't disagree with what the testifier said in terms of streamlining the paperwork. We have to remember that the documentation, though, most of it is coming from the federal government. And right now, what we have are teachers that are, they're teaching and they have all this time, but to be having one-on-one, but there's not a lot of time to do all of the necessary. I mean, it is, I don't know, I mean, maybe my testifier could talk to you, how much more it is than just an average teacher, the amount that they have to do. I mean, I can tell you our IEP meetings, I think we usually have 6 people in our IEP meetings. It's mm-hmm. a lot.
Yes, there are multiple people, and depending on the student, you got to remember these are individual. So each student deserves something different, and those people need to be stakeholders in the room, and that information has to be disseminated and shared and talked about and changed all the time. So it could take somewhere between 45 minutes to an hour just to have the meeting. And then after the meeting, the documentation has to be done and reviewed and approved and then finalized and filed. And then progress reports have to be done during report card time. And we still have to teach. We still have to be a part of conferences, just like every single teacher in the building. So it does take a lot of additional time. And if there are new students who need to be evaluated, it's a long evaluation process that takes multiple stakeholders, and that has to be researched, read, and sometimes you have information from outside facilities like your neuropsych evaluations. That information has to be taken in all at the same time, and we're mostly teachers. You know, we teach most of the time. Like I said, I devote 5 out of those 6 hours every day to teaching and adjusting my curriculum to fit the needs of students. So the paperwork ends up being something I do over the weekend in my free time. And like I said, there are districts that provide some support for due process, but it is not like a standard expectation for every single district.
Thank you so much. And Representative Sensenmura, follow-up? And thank you, Representative Sensenmura, for pointing out that these are legal documents, too, as well. Any other comments or questions? Seeing none, why don't you go ahead and do a wrap-up, Representative Edelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a really important discussion. We've had it for years. We know that we have this crisis going on within our schools where we have special educators that are coming to us year after year. They formed task force on their own, not even led by the legislature, to try to come together. Educators in just typical general ed classes are saying this is a priority for them to make sure that we're supporting our special educators. So I really do hope this is something that we can move the dial on this year. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Representative Edelson. With that, I'll motion to lay over House File 562 for possible inclusion in an education finance bill. Next up, we have House File 2134. Welcome to your committee, Representative Krisha. We'll let you get settled there. And why don't you go ahead and move House File 2134 before the committee for a possible inclusion in the education finance bill.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. I will make a motion to move 2134 and for possible inclusion in the education omnibus bill.
Thank you. With that, go ahead and start your testimony.
Thank you. So thank you, committee members. I'm going to be really brief so my testifiers can get a chance. I have with me Superintendent Greg Johnson, Principal Tim Bjorgi. I have Jeremy Epson who's going to talk on behalf of the Trucking Association, and then Kyle Wensman, who is a flight instructor. The bill you have in front of you is a Transportation Career Pathways bill, and you're going to hear more about it from them, but I just want to bring up a couple of points, and that is that really what we see now is we're a mobile society where supply chains are very important, and that is commerce, community, and charity. We see goods and services that have to move. We see families that have to move to get together with each other when you go see relatives and all that, and that's all part of that, as well as charity when you do organ donations and moving medical things around. So this bill is really a feeder program for the people behind that supply chain, whether they're the men and women that are pilots or driving trucks or mechanics or logistics or air traffic control. This is really getting that youth involved with understanding the possibilities of a career in the transportation industries. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Superintendent Greg Johnson first, and then just keep it moving.
Thank you, Superintendent. Please state the name for your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Greg Johnson, Superintendent of Little Falls Community Schools. I appreciate this opportunity to share my support of the development of a transportation pathway for students in our school district. The data is clear, the demand in the transportation fields is high, and a robust future lies ahead for aviation and CDL licensure careers. Our goal in Little Falls is to expose and give students access to the world of transportation and to explore the many aspects of the industry and career opportunities that exist in this important area in our commerce. Our role in Little Falls would be to identify and support those students who are passionate about aviation and over-the-road transportation, and hopefully fulfill their dreams by providing the foundation knowledge to launch them into these career areas. Little Falls has been a leader in work-based learning and student internships, providing our students with additional real-world career experiences will not only benefit them, but also benefit our local economy and businesses. This transportation pathway will give students the opportunity to apply the knowledge they learn in the classroom to real-world situations and potential career paths. An aviation and CDL pathway will allow our students to build relationships with employers, industry professionals, which can also be a valuable asset when it comes to finding employment after graduation. These types of pathways and learning experiences are especially beneficial for low-income students who may otherwise not have access to these types of experiences, professional networking, and social capital that plays a critical role in careers. Little Falls has the capacity and resources to support a transportation pathway due to a thriving local airport and access to Camp Ripley Military Base. There are also numerous businesses in our community that rely on a strong workforce and over-the-road transportation. There's no better time for our students to have expanded opportunities and experiences in transportation careers. The need is definitely there. Madam Chair and committee members, I appreciate your consideration and support of House File 2134 and the opportunity it could bring our students and local area. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Next up, we have Tim Bjorg. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Tim Bjorgi. I'm the high school principal in Little Falls and certainly in support of House File 2134, which establishes a transportation pathway in Little Falls, which fits nicely into our APPS program, which stands for Academies, Partnerships, and Pathways, where we try to provide experiences, education, and exposure in the areas of health and human services, information technology, business and manufacturing, and production. A transportation pathway would fit very nicely into our APPS program. Little Falls has 800 students in our high school. Roughly half of those students go on to post-secondary education. The other half enter the workforce. As we attempt to provide them with the experience and exposure and education to be ready for the world's best workforce, it's important to us that we give kids the opportunity to experience a multitude of experiences. Just one example before I finish is We have a unique partnership with Camp Ripley. This fall, we sent 15 students there to do an intense job shadow program in some different areas, including aviation, maintenance and facilities, law enforcement, natural resources, and had an opportunity to witness two students flying in a Black Hawk simulator, which sparked their interest to go into an aviation career field. We also had students working on trucks and tanks, and again, that experience alone has encouraged them to go into the area of diesel mechanics. And so a transportation academy, we would look to duplicate what we do in health science, which is have students graduate from high school with certification as a CNA. We'd have them graduate from high school with a license, either a private pilot's license or a CDL license. Wonderful opportunity for students. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Principal Bjorgi. Next up, we've got Kyle Wensman and then Jeremy Estenson. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Kyle Wensman. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am a flight instructor at the local flight school in Little Falls Lakes Area Aviation, and over the last year or so, we've held a number of ground school courses in partnership with community education through the Little Falls School District. And our goal with this was to introduce aviation as a career option for young people who may otherwise not have access. And this bill would allow us to continue to expand that access, not only to pilots, but also to the support network underneath them, air traffic control, aviation mechanics, inspectors, and that sort of thing. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill, and I appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And Mr. Estenson, state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Jeremy Estenson. I work for Taft Advisors here on behalf of the Minnesota Trucking Association, supporting Representative Carisha's bill today. A couple quick statistics, knowing that time is short. The average truck driver in the United States is now over 50 years old in Minnesota. That's creeping up on 55 years old. The average salary of a truck driver is almost $85,000. So it's a good job, but it's not the sort of job that a lot of young people are particularly interested in anymore. And this driver shortage that's been going for a little over a decade now has only gotten worse post-COVID for a whole variety of reasons. But one of the challenges not unique to trucking is that there just aren't younger people particularly interested in this piece of machinery that Representative Carisha's bill would help to put in Little Falls, we think would give exposure. But further than that, trucking is a safety entity. They exist to deliver things safely. And technology changes all the time. Ongoing education opportunities are somewhat rare. These machines aren't particularly common. And as I understand in conversations with Representative Carisha and the folks from the school district, local businesses would be able to engage and use the piece of machinery to train folks on new equipment. So we see a whole bunch of benefits, Madam Chair. Happy to answer questions, but very supportive of the bill.
Thank you so much. With that, members, any comments or questions at the table? Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess just to go back and get some clarification, it says in the bill that it's one-time funds for equipment, staffing costs, travel costs, and for contracted services. So I can see equipment costs might be a one-time cost, but staffing and those kinds seem to be ongoing. So could you tell us a little bit more about exactly, specifically? I mean, we know the fields that we're supporting, but the mechanisms that this money would be, how it would be spent to support those fields.
Representative Carisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would entertain a verbal amendment to double this if that's what you're asking. But no, Representative Pryor, so the idea behind this is to get it rolling, to buy the equipment, the two simulators, and then the school has already started to work with teachers that could work, and they're getting AOPA curriculum as well as commercial drivers. So to get this up and moving, when I put this together, I really believe in getting a program seated, but then it should stand on its own legs. And if it really is as good as it could be, I think we could find the community funds for that. It does have a community education component, which would allow this to be leased out to companies that need refresher driving courses, or the aviation school as they're working with pilots. So it really is just designed to be a seed program, and then the ongoing cost would have to be done by the success of the program as well as the community.
Representative Bryan.
And just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. 800 students in the high school, and then the students that would be eligible for the program, are, do you anticipate, is there, yeah, and I know that there's a report about how many students enrolled, but is there kind of like a range where you say, okay, this is where our payoff is, this number of students, and following up in these careers afterwards?
Representative Krishna, or do you want one of the?
Sure, I can jump on that. So, so the ROI on that is, right now, this would start out as low as the 7th and 8th grade. And we have the programs that I've seen the flight school move through and other ones. They've gotten at least 6 students moving into college now. We believe that could easily triple as more and more students get interested. And the real benefit of this is college is incredibly expensive, aviation school as well as commercial driver's license. And if a student can get their private pilot's license before they leave school, that student can save about $100,000 and be sitting quicker in the right seat of a jet, or the same with waiting to get their 21-year-old certificate to drive. So really what this does is it accelerates for the students. It saves some costs as a higher ed. And Mark Gill, who's not testifying, advocated heavily for this, and I believe in that, and putting these simulators in the school themselves, because once the school sees this, once the students see that, they can jump in between classes or study halls. They will find time to get interested in this, and we'll have teachers or instructors available so that they can start to learn about that. I hope that answers your question, Representative.
Representative Pryor, follow-up? With that, any further questions? Representative Eltendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Krishna, and thank you to all of your testifiers that drove quite a distance to come here today. I do think this is a fantastic opportunity, and really excited about your ingenuity of looking outside of the box. You know, these are the kind of things that keep students involved in school. When they love one thing like this, they are going to do better in math and science and everything, because they're going to be motivated to go to that second level of school. So I just commend you for thinking outside of the box. We are at a, you know, talk about this a lot, but a shortage of pilots, and this would just be a great way to introduce more kids. But long-term is getting them into a career that they're going to love, and that's what's exciting, is thinking about them going to school and being excited about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf. Seeing no further questions, Representative Grisha, close it up.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Madam Chair, for your consideration and for the conciseness of the time. Before I close, Representative Edelson, I didn't get a chance to say this, but I love the last bill. I love the fact that you're taking those hard conversations. I know there's some work to do, and yes, we did work on that together. So thank you for that. But you had left the room, and I didn't get a chance to say that. So just closing this, members, our area, transportation is a huge need. Camp Ripley, where we're located near, we see this coming all the time with the young soldiers as they're getting in. You may not know this, but in Little Falls, we have Little Falls Machine, which is one of the largest providers of snow plows. And having these young men and women trained to be behind these big equipment, whether it's big, fast iron flying through the sky or big iron that's driving the snow plows, we need these drivers. We need the people sitting behind those. And this program will start to get interest in that. The idea behind this is not only to get to the students in the school, but also to provide a community resource. If you've been to Little Falls and you've seen the work that these gentlemen have done, and the educators, they are always community outreach. They open the school for Thanksgiving meals, for all sorts of things. This is just one more extension of that, and working closely with Camp Ripley. So what will happen is this I believe will be successful, and we're already talking about, if we could get this done in 2 years, how we would be helping other schools around the state and in rural parts of Minnesota, so that they could also be building these programs to help their students get involved in the career transportation pathways. So with that, that's the fastest I've had to talk in a long time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Krishan. Thank you for bringing this forward. From the moment you told me it, that was very interesting. So with that, I'll lay over House File 2134 for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill. And members, thanks for your work today. We have a reminder, we have our regular scheduled meetings on Wednesday and Thursday, but then also make sure on your calendar is this Friday at 10:30 as well for another agenda. So with that, we are adjourned.